Hey guys, Jim Cox, and I'm here with an interview with Zach Ellsworth. We'd actually connected on Facebook, and he has a background that I found interesting in leftist philosophy and economy. And so wanted to talk to him to kind of learn more about the subject and kind of discuss where we're at today. So Zach, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Awesome. I appreciate it.
So tell us a little bit about your background. How did you become interested or involved in kind of learning more about the political left?
Well, for me, it's been kind of a zigzag, so to speak. The first driving passion of my life was urban planning. I've always just been kind of fascinated with cities and how they operate and all that sort of thing. So I went to school, got my undergraduate, and then my master's in urban planning. Through there, I learned about the sub-philosophy of new urbanism, which is things like, it's basically just good community design. So things like walkability, being able to access your job, your places for entertainment, all the destinations of your daily life within walking distance or a short bike ride or whatever. Things like mixed use, doing not just residential buildings, but incorporating in commercial and other stuff like that, as well as things like meaningful architecture, real sense of place, and having everything be very interconnected and robust in terms of like mass transit. So you can take your bike to the light rail and take the light rail to your destination, stuff like that. And so that was really my first passion. And then as I was getting out of my undergraduate degree, I got into natural landscaping, which eventually led me to permaculture, which is my second big passion. I got really interested in that. And permaculture, just in brief, is basically a design system where you can take anything and make it more sustainable, more robust, more resilient to shocks. And it consists of three ethics, those being earth care, people care, and then the third ethic, which is somewhat controversial in the movement, but basically it boils down to what's called fair share. So the idea of returning the surplus of whatever you produce to the service of the first two ethics. And it also has to do with David Holmgren, one of the originators, laid out 12 principles of permaculture. And they're things like observe and interact, obtain a yield, design from the patterns to the details and stuff like that. And so I saw a lot of parallels between both new urbanism and permaculture. And I thought, you know, what if we put those two ideas together and saw what we come up with? And in fact, there had been a movement to do just that, which was the transition towns movement, the idea that we're all facing these big existential threats of things like climate change and at the time peak oil, although that's kind of gone by the wayside in recent years. Not many people talk about that anymore. But their idea was to reimagine society in a way that we can meet all our needs without compromising the needs of future generations to do the same. And so I got into that movement. Started an organization in the Twin Cities where I live. And I had a good time connecting with other people that were thinking about the same sort of things that I was. But I always kind of felt there was something lacking. I would go to these meetings and it was all people who had houses, who were financially secure, who had the time and the money to really play with these ideas. And so it seems like it wasn't quite accessible to everyone. And so I kind of cast it about for a while for something that would make my first two passions make more sense. And then the housing bubble burst in 08. And following that, the Occupy Wall Street protests got going. And that really elevated my consciousness a whole lot, before that point, I hadn't really thought too much about any sort of leftist theory. Through like high school, we would read books like 1984 and Animal Farm and stuff like that. And the interpretations that I would get through professors and through classmates was that things like communism and socialism and all that stuff, that it might sound nice on paper, but when it comes down to it, it just leads to more totalitarianism. So I had kind of put that aside in the back of my mind for a long time, but then Occupy came and kind of reawakened a lot of that stuff, those ideas that, hey, maybe there is something different than the current system that we live in, what I had been used to my entire life. And so then after a while, I got into podcasting. I wasn't producing podcasts myself yet, but I just got really interested in podcasts, and just through kind of the meanderings of, you know, this show being recommended and that show being recommended, and just my interests changing, I got to some actual leftist content, and they were talking about ideas like the labor theory of value and workers owning the means of production and stuff like that, that I didn't really have much contact with before that point. And so all of this kind of just kept, I don't know, I'd say like building in the back of my mind. And then the Bernie Sanders candidacy also really catapulted a lot of these ideas to the forefront of my mind as well. And I just kept learning and finding new creators and new ideas to pursue. And finally, I got to the point where I was exposed to these actual leftist theories of not just Karl Marx, but people like Peter Kropotkin and some of the other older communists and anarchists. And just from there, just kept going, found other people that were sharing my interests, found other creators that were talking about the kinds of things that I found really interesting. And it just kind of gone from there. So when I finally arrived at all these leftist ideas, it really started making things like permaculture and new urbanism make a whole lot more sense. When you have that kind of horizontal organization structure where everyone has a say, you're injecting more democracy into whatever system that you're creating, then instead of things like transition towns where you tend to get the well-to-do, you get kind of more of a slice of life. You get things that are good for everybody. And so I've been just kind of trying to synthesize all these three ideas together into something new, a new guiding force. And when you have a new philosophy, you kind of need a new name for it. So the name that I came up with is the theory of Solaris. So Solaris is a Latin word. It means of the sun. And I believe that it makes a good metaphor for what I think is at the bottom of all these three philosophies. Whether it's new urbanism, permaculture, or any sort of leftist theory, when it comes down to it, it's all about building connection and building interconnection and sharing rather than taking. So I feel that the sun, the thing that connects us all, I mean, literally and figuratively, the thing that makes all the food grows that we either eat ourselves or we feed to the food that we later eat, all the energy that has allowed us to shape our modern world comes in the form of either fossilized solar energy or more direct or indirect solar energy in wind or solar power. Pretty much every sort of energy on Earth aside from nuclear is directly from the sun. So I feel it's a good metaphor for interconnectedness. And so that's kind of how I arrived at that and just kind of gone from there.
That's awesome. So I, you know, I usually don't take notes, but I found that I've already taken a ton of notes in order to try to keep track of, like,
it's a lot of concepts I'm throwing.
So many things to like drill down into. And, sure. So one of the things that you, mention is transition towns. So how old is this concept of transition town that it's been around? Like, is this something new, or is this something from like the 80s or 90s? I'm like, how far does this go back?
It's relatively new. The guy who started it, I believe, is only in maybe his mid 40s. Let me just, I can look it up real quick, in fact. But I think it came about some around like the early aughts, or maybe even the teens.
Is there cases where like transition, so what's the definition of a transition town? Is it one that is based on sustainability, or is it something, is it an end result in itself, or is it something to push society towards yet another level?
I think it's both a destination and kind of a process as well. Just looking it up, it looks like it started only in 2005 in England. And they actually have a framework you can follow their steps to becoming an official transition town of the movement. I don't know where I was going with that, but yeah, basically it's just a process of connecting with neighbors and then using your democratic power to do things like shape ordinances. It can be anything as simple as like, you know, you have an ordinance in your town against owning chickens. Will you go ahead and you get enough people together and change that, you know, putting more, sensible ordinances that balance everybody's needs. It could be something like, it could be something as big as changing the land use code to allow things like mixed use buildings so that people don't have to rely on, cars as much, and so that things can be a little more compact. It's things like that.
So really it goes towards better efficiency, more participation, and you know, that gets back to again your connecting to leftist theory. Now, like you said, like there's a lot of criticism of leftist thinking that, oh, there's the communists and socialists, they'll take over and, you know, destroy freedom and leads to totalitarianism, like you said. In reality, you know, I just don't see that as the case. I mean, I think if you look at the cases of, you know, where people point to, those were in fact authoritarian regimes to begin with, you know?
Right.
And they were either communist or socialist in name only, and not really an example of, like you described, real democratic principles, you know? So, I mean, that mislabeling has been something that, you know, the political system has been using to pillory the left for over 100 years, you know?
Absolutely.
So how do you get to a point where this just doesn't become a name calling match, which where labels don't even have any value, you know? They're really just triggers to close off any discussion of any real value.
Yep, they're basically just a way to shut down discussion and declare yourself the victor without having to make any points or anything.
Or even to defend yourself. I mean,
right, yeah. You just, commie, and then that's it, yep.
Yeah, capitalism means freedom. Well, I think if you look at the economy these days, you know, there's several million people that would, argue that point.
Right, absolutely. So I think one of the factors that kind of combats that sort of a mentality is just time. It's been decades and decades since the McCarthy era and the Red Scare, where terms like that were enough to get people thrown in jail or to get protests shut down or whatever. So people in my generation, I consider myself an elder millennial, but people in my generation and the generations coming up haven't grown up under a time when communism has been, you know, even much of a reality around the world. I mean, you still have China left as a major world power, but the USSR fell in the 90s, which is before a lot of before all of the Zoomers were born, and before a lot of my generation was even all that aware. I barely even remember it happening. Remember talking about it probably in current events in grade school, but that's about it. So I just don't think we have the same stigma attached to it that previous generations have had. There's that. Then there's also the material conditions that are continuing to kind of stagnate for the middle and working classes. With the fight for minimum wage increase that hasn't happened in, I think it's been 20 years now since they've raised it up. People are feeling a real and direct impact of their wages not going anywhere and their ability to even do things like pay rent and keep food in their refrigerator is shrinking year by year as there's not better and better jobs being created and the bottom is just not being lifted up. So there's that factor that's working in our favor. And then there's also things like Occupy and then Bernie Sanders' candidacy, as well as people like AOC and others coming to the fore, good role models of, and I wouldn't call them necessarily leftist. I mean, they're definitely not out and out socialist or communist or anything, but they're at least talking about democratic socialist ideas. So things like the Scandinavian model, just providing a robust safety net for people, favoring things like unions, stuff like that, stuff that hasn't been talked about in generations, really. I mean, basically since the Reagan and Margaret Thatcher era, neoliberalism has been the rallying point of the day. It's the thing that both sides, if you will, of the US political parties have been able to agree on, that, you know, we should do away with things like social safety nets. You know, Bill Clinton got rid of outright welfare and in favor of the welfare to work system, and just been a long and slow erosion of social safety programs and well, at the same time, continually bailing out businesses that get in trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, like again, the Wall Street bailout that happened around 2008. I think it's all of those programs coming back to bite everyone who's been espousing them for all these generations. Like there's only so long that you can erode the power and the even the money of the people that you depend on to buy your products as a business owner before it's going to end up hurting you too.
And I think you see that coming, you know, the proof in the pudding really coming home with the COVID pandemic. And
absolutely,
you know, most of the jobs that were created between 2009 and 2020, most of those jobs were service-related jobs. Those were the jobs that have actually been eliminated or killed off in large measure by COVID because of, you know, what needs to be done to control the spread of the virus. But the reality is that those were, you know, a lot of those were low-paying, low-wage jobs. And you really... it was difficult even in the best of times to support a family on it, let alone, you know, have kids or to get ahead. And that was not always the case. And, you know, clearly we've gotten to a point where we've lost a lot of those jobs now. And it's like, where do we go from here? So, so you mentioned, you know, one of the things that really sticks me is the fact of, like, when you drill down to it, like neoliberalism and capitalism, like what is the ultimate thing that they're trying to protect? Like, what's at the core of the value system. And to me, the core of the value system is accumulation of wealth without regard to anything else.
And absolutely.
When you look at socialist or communist or anarchist philosophy, what's at the core of that value system? What would you say?
I would say it's first and foremost, providing for everyone's basic needs. So things like housing, food, water, heat, but also things like transportation, access to education, access to community and communication, I think is a big one, especially in our digital age. I think those can be argued as basic necessities for life at this point. So there's that. There's putting it down a floor under which no one can fall. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, spreading out power as far and as between as many hands as possible, at least in my opinion, that is what leftism broadly is all about. So democracy, people love concepts like democracy and freedom and self-determination, all these sorts of things. And yet under our current system, you spend an entire third of your adult life until the age of retirement at your workplace, you know, 8 hours a day. How much freedom, how much democracy, how much self-direction do you actually have unless you're an owner? Probably not very much. Uh-huh. So why is democracy and freedom okay when it comes to political issues and exercising our power at the ballot box, but when it comes to what we spend most of our life, most of our waking hours doing, somehow that's not okay. And we instead go in favor of a very authoritarian top-down system where we have things like at-will employment. You don't have much power or ability to negotiate your wages or your working conditions, the safety measures that might be in place if it's a dangerous job. You don't have much ability to negotiate your benefits or even the hours that you work. You know, it's all dictated to you by whoever the owner is and whoever they appoint to do their will as a manager.
Well, even from a standpoint of just, I mean, political freedom or political mm-hmm. power, I mean, that's been subverted by Citizens United and really yes. the corporate overtaking of institutions that, you know, should have some representation in terms of individuals, but it's becoming increasingly difficult as, you know, you have money rolling mm-hmm. into campaigns to really control agendas, whether it's agendas around, you know, dealing with climate change or dealing with, you know, human rights issues or, you know, personal safety, whatever, what have you.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you have neither, I would say, political freedom or economic freedom. The underlying fact, though, the underlying thing of value, though, I think that really stands out and I think is really not come up is the value of human life, you mm-hmm. know, to the left. And I would say that the left, to me, a leftist philosophy means that every human life is valuable, mm-hmm. which, as radical as that sounds, is also inherently spiritual and I would dare say, you know, Christian, mm-hmm. you know, that every person has purpose and has value. And, you know, we're kind of going through this existence, you know, what is our, why are we here? What's our goal? And if our goal is to get the best quality of existence for each person, you know, how does that fit into a world where you have that top-down control
right.
that has one goal, which is basically subjugating everybody for the purpose of more dollars.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't. Yeah.
No, definitely not. You know, whether it's Citizens United sorts of things, where more dollars equals more votes more often than not, whether it's boycotts, where it's vote with your dollars, all these sorts of schemes mean that the more dollars you have, the more votes you have. So if you don't have much, you don't have much freedom. So yeah, I definitely think that it is all about bodily autonomy and personal freedom to live your highest and best life, whatever that may be. Maybe you work so hard that you don't even have time to stop and think about, well, what would I do if I had, you know, my basic necessities met? Would I become an artist and contribute to the world in a way that I otherwise may never? And we the world may be impoverished for never having had. Would I be a teacher? Would I spend more time with my kids, raising my kids to be the best people that they can be, to usher in the next generation and try and make it better than the one that's currently in charge?
Yeah. And this really gets to the issue of universal basic income that's been
absolutely
brought up with Andrew Yang, who you know, I supported during the primaries, and I actually interviewed him before he actually started running. And but I think this whole idea of universal basic income is really something whose time has come, in a way that it's much more feasible, I guess, given kind of changes in monetary theory with MMT and right. so forth. So
absolutely so. I think it definitely is something that, you know, it just keeps coming back as an issue that they're toying with. And it seems like COVID especially has laid bare the need for just being able to keep people at a basic level if tragedies like this happen, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sure we're all going to breathe a very heavy sigh of relief once we're all pretty much vaccinated and we're beyond this COVID business. But there's nothing to say that there's not another bug coming around the corner or some other climate catastrophe. You know, if the jet stream gets shut off by all this polar melt or whatever, and we're dealing with more Arctic blasts every winter, and places like Texas, places that are not prepared to deal with that kind of cold, are getting hit year after year. So yeah, UBI is of course not going to solve all of those problems, but it's definitely going to smooth it over a lot. It would have allowed people to stay home. People wouldn't have been worried about losing their homes or their businesses or their source of income if they had that little bit of cushion. And the countries that provided it more are countries that came out of COVID a lot faster, places like New Zealand and South Korea. So yeah, I think it's definitely an idea whose time has come. And it sounds like in the few places, I just heard they had tried it out in Stockton, California, and they found that people were more likely to get jobs when they had that extra cushion. They weren't worrying about constantly scrambling to get bills done and you know, provide childcare or whatever it was. It got
that's the thing. It takes money in order to earn money. And right. So the fact that there's, I mean, even a $15 minimum wage still keeps you in poverty. You know, it's right. still poverty, below the poverty level. And so, you know, the fact is that, you know, if you have kids, you need to provide childcare, you need to have transportation, you need to be able to get the clothes for what you're doing, you need to pay your rent, and mm-hmm. you know, and that's even before doing the actual job and then trying to get compensated. So, you know, it just, you know, and the toll that it takes in terms of the humanity of people, I think is just, that's the real price that we're paying. And you see it in terms of depression, suicide rates, you know, right. substance abuse, in terms of people's quality of life, that really should not have to be the case. And that's what's truly soul crushing, I think.
Right. Yeah. Poverty is a compounding problem. It costs a lot of money to remain poor.
Yeah. Yeah. What, now, you mentioned Kropotkin and anarchism. You know, when mm-hmm. people hear the word anarchists, they think, you know, bomb-throwing maniacs. But In fact, that's not the case. And can you share a little bit about anarchism and why people are wrong to think that?
Sure. I think people do think that much in the same way that, or much for the same reasons that people have a bad opinion of communism. It's been a term that's been maligned and manipulated by the powers that be over the decades and centuries. What anarchism means more than anything is the freedom to live your life as you choose, as long as you're not hurting other people and preventing other people from doing the same. It means the freedom to decide what you want for your life and to not have some, again, top-down authoritarian tell you that, no, you have to instead go and work for a job that you hate or do things that you disagree with. It's about, more than anything, I would say, spreading of power. It seems that in the long arc of history, we've gone from starting out with basically a horizontal system when we all lived in tribes and bands, where you might have a chief, you might have a medicine doctor, or what a spiritual shaman, whatever term would be used. But other than that, there's not a whole lot of hierarchy. You might have had a top soldier in your little group or whatever, but more or less people have the same political and everyday autonomy. And then at some point, people learned that they could hoard resources. Not only did that give them power over their neighbors, where they could wait out famine, they could sustain longer campaigns of warfare, but it also allowed them to control the people around them. And eventually that led to things like feudalism, basically, where you have the divine right of kings and you have all this apparatus set up to entrench power at the top. And that lasted for hundreds and hundreds of years until finally capitalism came along and said, we don't really believe in the divine right of kings. We don't think there's anything inherent about what this person does that says that they should get to make all the decisions. And, you know, over the course of decades and hundreds of years, they emerged as the dominant force. And it wasn't exactly a linear thing. It never is. They were crushed time and time again by whatever feudal lord didn't like what they were doing. But eventually they wrested some of that power away from monarchs and even from the clergy into their own hands as entrepreneurs and business owners. And so what I and other leftists see is that this is just a continuation of that long arc of history of wresting power from the few into the hands of the many and then spreading it out. And every time we see that happening, whatever human rights movement it is or political structure or struggle that is, or union organizing, every time you spread power out, there's a positive result. There's more good for more people. So in my mind, that's what anarchy does eventually. And it's going to be a long process. I don't have any illusions that it's something that's just going to, you know, come about fully formed tomorrow. But to have an anarchist mindset to me is to work for as best you can with whatever means you have, organizing power and trying to draw it away from its power centers, wherever they be right now, and spread it amongst as many people, because then you're going to end up having the most good for the most people. And that's basically it.
So what are some examples of like a truly anarchist or socialist society where this kind of overturning of neoliberal power, are there any examples at all?
Yeah, that's very difficult. Yeah. The thing about it is they tend to start up really fast. Like during the Spanish Revolution, there was a group of anarchists. I don't recall what region it was offhand, but they managed to create a pretty egalitarian, horizontally organized society for a few years, but then they ended up getting crushed by the fascists. And this tends to happen again and again. And like I said, just as it probably happened, or it did happen with capitalist uprisings, I'm sure they were crushed time and time again before finally they gained a foothold. But if you look at the current day, the two examples that come to my mind are one, the Zapatista movement in Mexico. They basically have carved a not small portion of Mexico out as, for lack of a better word, an autonomous zone, where the Mexican government doesn't have a lot of say. They don't try to interfere. They just kind of let them do what they want. And they have a very horizontal structure. I don't know. I mean, it all depends on your definitions. But as far as I'm concerned, they have a very horizontal structure in the way that they, in the way they structure political power. They'll have, you know, small meetings in a village, and then they will decide on something altogether as a village. They'll send a representative to a larger meeting and to a larger meeting, and it's kind of.
Is that still the case there?
Yeah, they still have control.
That's interesting.
Over that region. Yeah,
that's interesting, because during the 1800s, 1900s, that area and the Zapatista movement were actually really linchpins in terms of opposing centralization of government. And so I have to think that long a period of time really instilled an educational and a sociological background, mm-hmm. which makes it more likely for that to take root and to succeed. I mean, the challenge is when you're in quote unquote normal society, you know, you go through an educational system that's you've been conditioned to be a cog, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And to accept what's going on and to hear the code words that they throw around for things to trigger you and to draw a response, but you don't have that same environment conditioning young minds, and that they're actually open to this different outlook of priorities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they definitely made the space, and it's really interesting the way they did it. I don't know a great deal about it, but apparently they broke away from the Mexican government. They declared themselves as in opposition to the Mexican government. But then they took a long time to integrate themselves with the native peoples in the areas of Chiapas that they settled in, to kind of integrate their system of thinking and their, you know, languages and life ways and all that sort of thing, and kind of make the synthesis between, they call themselves national, or they call themselves, libertarian socialists. So they integrated those kind of European ideas in with the indigenous ideas, and they've kind of, it seems like it's working for them. They've been around since the 90s, and they're still, as far as I know, they haven't lost any land. They haven't suffered any huge defeats. So that's one good example. And then there's also in a region of Syria, there is another group, and they go by a bunch of different names, but basically the blanket term for them is the area of Rojava. And in similar fashion, their leader, who at one time was a warlord and did terrible things, got sent to prison and learned about the work of Murray Bookchin, who was I think he was one of the founders of the philosophy of kind of green anarchism or green anarchy. So the idea of folding in ecological ideas in with anarchist thinking, spreading power not only to all people, but to all living things, viewing them all as part of one larger community of living things, each with, you know, rights and autonomy and all that sort of thing. And he influenced his people to create basically a new society based on those sorts of principles. And they continue to hang in there. I mean, despite pretty bad odds. I mean, they're in Syria, one of the most war-torn parts of the earth at this time. But they've been instrumental in things like fighting back against ISIS. The U.S. had kind of I don't know if it was a formal partnership, but they were working together to some degree at a point to fight back against ISIS in, or whatever the term for the ISIS is in Syria. And they too have a very horizontally organized structure where they try to elevate the voices of marginalized people, women and other minorities that may not have had as much of a voice in the past, and together try to share power. But at the same time, they're very militant against people that would try and come in and overtake them, so to speak.
So what would you say is, we're getting towards the end of our time,
sure,
and you know, clearly we have, you know, 20 more shows to do together, which is great.
Glad to hear it.
Which is great. But what would you say is a first step for people to execute in order to move from like neoliberal thinking to leftist thinking? Like what can people do to actually start to effect a change in priorities and in behavior?
Sure. I think
like nothing like super complicated, but sure. Like what can people do in their lives?
I think the first and most important thing to do is to kind of evaluate what you value in your own life. Do you value freedom? Do you value democracy? Do you think that people are more or less born equal? And so deserve an equal shot at having as good of a life as they can. And if the answers to all those are yes, then I would say the next step is to start seeking out either literature, especially if you're not in an area that has big population centers, but seek out literature and also people that already have been thinking about these sorts of ideas. And it doesn't matter what type of leftism you start with, you're probably going to end up being, you're not going to start out and end up in the same school of thought, probably. It's going to take a while to kind of get your groove and figure out what makes most sense to you. And just, you know, kind of just be open to the ideas that capitalism is not the end of history. There's something that we could do together to get past it that provides for the needs of everybody. We already produce enough food, enough shelter, enough of all of life's necessities for every person. It's just a matter of getting it to the people that need it. So seek out organizations. If you have a Facebook account, you could come to one of the two groups that I manage, one of those being Left Pod Posting, where we talk about all sorts of leftist podcasts. And there's actually a bunch of leftist podcast creators that hang out there and post about their stuff and talk about it. And then the other group I have is Left Signal Boost. Those are both groups on Facebook. Just go ahead and join them and just kind of start asking questions. You know, we're very open. I try to cultivate a very open and welcoming community in both of those spaces. If you want any suggestions for books or podcasts, whatever your media is, or if you want to know about organizations to join, if you're ready to take that step, there's going to be people there that we'd be more than happy to help with pointing you in the right direction, at least.
Yeah. I like the idea of identifying what's important to you. By the same token, as you identify what's important to you, I think also identify what's holding back that value manifesting itself, and how do you, you know, what role does that play in your life? But No, I think that's an excellent starting point, because we really have to kind of internalize our own sense of self-worth, but also the value of human life and mm-hmm. other human life. You mentioned leftism. I mean, by the same token, you can interchange the term humanism. You know, sure. We're talking about, just the value of the human species and, you know, not being subjugated by a few, but
right.
for the benefit of all.
Right.
If people want to, other than on your Facebook groups, how can people reach out to you if they want to chat more with you?
Sure. Well, the absolute best way to chat with me is to join my live streams on Twitch. If you're not familiar with the Twitch platform, it's basically like YouTube, but live. So if you go to twitch.com and search for bread_theory, you can find my channel. I stream every Friday at 9 p.m. Central Standard Time. And the cool thing about the live experience is there's a chat that's running throughout the entire broadcast. So you can just pose your question and then I'll be right there to answer it for you. I go through the audiobooks of leftist thinkers. So right now we're working on The Conquest of Bread by Peter Kropotkin, one of the founders of anarchist theory. And I just do a chapter a week and I'll pause and kind of give my own opinion about it and maybe try and help apply it to some of the philosophies that I care about and think about and help people apply it to modern day life. And beyond that, if you want to follow me at any other platform, I have a podcast, I have a YouTube channel, I have a whole bunch of projects that are going on. And if you want links to those Facebook groups, the best way to get all of those links is to go to my Linktree account. And that's at Linktree, that's linktr.ee/B in bread_T in theory. So Linktree/bread theory.
Gotcha. Awesome. Well, Zach, we got like a bunch of rabbit holes to go down in the future, but what I'd like to do is maybe come back in about a month or so and explore some more. So I appreciate your taking the time to chat, and we'll talk again.
I would love that. And hopefully by then I've figured out this whole Zoom thing better and we can actually have video to go along with the audio.
No problem. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks a lot.
Talk to you soon. Thanks so much.